This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Tonight I'm doing a talk called Five Themes of Libri Revisited. And this is a talk that is not my own. I've put much of it into my own words over the past few weeks, but this is a talk that that Dick has done for many years in different contexts, different places. And I want to sort of continue the tradition, not for the sake of continuing tradition, but because these five general areas of thought are very important and are as relevant today as they were when Dick first started talking about them, when Francis Schaeffer talked about a lot of these things, and many people who've worked in Libri and out of Libri also. It's important for me to mention that what these five themes are not before we launch into them. They are not Libri's equivalent of a creed or a catechism. So they're in no way are they a summary of all Christian belief or something like that. They're not really specific to Libri. We have talked about these things a lot in Libri over the years, but they're not unique to Libri at all, as if we have our own Libri theology or something like that. Each theme that I'll be talking about is basically a response. That's what this is. It's a response to misunderstandings or failures that have dogged the church for a long time, or misunderstandings that we see in the culture around us. And areas that still need addressing and clarifying. So there's an aspect of this talk which is sort of a corrective, looking at some things that have been misunderstood in Christian circles particularly. And as with most of what we talk about at Libri, this lecture is kind of born out of a concern for the church, a concern for the culture, and born out of many, many conversations with students that we have here. Who have drawn our attention to things that are really important. So there's nothing about this, these particular categories that we've chosen to talk about. There's nothing about them that's chiseled into stone. It's very subject to change. It happens to be the same five themes that Dick was talking about years ago, but that's because those same five themes are just still very relevant. That's all. So the themes are, without further ado, the Christian faith is true. I word them in terms of statements here. The Christian faith is true, so the truth of the Christian faith. The supernatural is real. Spirituality is a human thing. We live under the shadow of the fall. And lastly, Jesus Christ is Lord over all of life. And so these are obviously very big and broad topics that cover a lot of Christian thought. My approach tonight is that I'll sort of explain each theme, explain the idea a little bit, and then I'll spend some time talking about the implications of each one. So implications meaning, if this is so, then it means this and this and this, and just sort of chase some of the what is implied by each one of these themes. And please do not expect smooth transitions from me tonight. I will be grinding gears quite a lot as we go from one theme to the next. We'll start off with the truth of the Christian faith. And this may seem very, very obvious. To people who are Christians, this may sound almost too obvious, but it actually really is not, practically speaking, in the world today. This is the fundamental idea that there is a reality. And there are beliefs that are either true to reality, and there's beliefs that are not true to reality. So a thought or an idea or a statement can either correspond to what is, or it can fail to correspond to what is. If I say two different statements, if I say this is Friday night, and then I also say this is not Friday night, it's impossible for both of those claims to be true, right? Because if one is true, it negates the other. Each statement is either true or false depending on its relationship to reality, whether it actually is Friday night. That's a very boring illustration, but the reason for being a Christian is that the Christian faith is true to reality. What the Bible reveals to us about who God is, about creation, about people, about where we came from and where we're going, about what our problem is and about what the solution is, it actually corresponds to the way things are. God is actually there. He is an absolute and universal reality. When we believe in Him, we are in step with reality. We are closer to reality when we believe in Him. And this is really the fundamental reason for being a Christian, because we believe it's true. Its truth is the primary thing. Implications of this. His existence does not depend on my believing in Him, or in the strength of my belief. He doesn't flicker on and off like the lights, depending on how much, you know, belief energy I'm producing or whatever, you know. Just because I want something to be true doesn't make it true in this sense. Just because some people don't want God to exist doesn't make Him not exist. All that is to say, God is not inside of my head. God is not inside of anybody's head. He is outside our heads. He is completely, while intimately involved, He is completely independent of our minds. So the image that often comes to mind for me is in the story of Peter Pan, where fairies exist, right? But every time a child says, "I don't believe in fairies," a fairy drops dead somewhere, right? You know? So there's a way in which the existence of fairies depends on the belief of children. And, you know, when Tinkerbell is dead or dying or something, you know, all the kids around the world, like, sort of, you know, drum up some support for Tinkerbell, and suddenly she flickers back to life. You know? So it's precisely not what the God of the universe is in terms of dependence on our belief. This means, contrary to many assumptions in the world today of people we maybe talk to every day, God is not a cultural construct. Or an idea invented and developed by people over hundreds of thousands of years for social reasons. That's one of the main ways in which religion is explained today, by neuroscientists and evolutionary biologists. That there's, you know, religion obviously serves some key reproductive function in early humanity, and that's why we have religions today. But to say that Christianity is the truth is to really contradict that claim strongly. Neither is Christianity merely a psychological or a comforting psychological reality. Now, it may actually have huge social benefits to believe in God, and there may actually be psychologically comforting things about believing in God. Those things are true, I think, but that's not the primary reason why we should believe. We should expect the Christian faith to be transformative in our lives, but only because it is first and foremost true. It brings us into touch with the God who is actually there and can heal and can transform. And He is not a psychological experience. He's a person who exists. And this might be a claim actually that's challenging even to some Christians. It's obviously a claim that many non-Christians would completely reject, but it's challenging even to some of us. Because it's not enough to believe solely because it has been helpful to believe. That's not a good enough reason. Many professing Christians don't really want to have conversations about the universal truth of what they believe. And I can relate to this in some ways. It gets uncomfortable to talk about your faith as a universal truth because many of our neighbors would just find that to be a completely offensive idea. right? It leads us into uncomfortable conversations, right? We are much more comfortable talking about it in personal or private terms. It changed my life. It made a huge difference for me. It helped me get over this problem I had. It works for me. It helps me. It's improved my life in some way or another. But not that it's the truth, right? Because nobody can contradict you when you say it was helpful to me. Who are they to say that you're wrong because the Christian faith was helpful to you? But the second you make a claim to the truth of it that would contradict anybody else's views, it's become very, very thorny, particularly in this part of the world. Neither is it enough to believe because you have grown up in a Christian home with Christian friends and attended a Christian school, and it has been by far the most socially comfortable thing to be a Christian. That's not a good enough reason to believe either. The earliest Christians went against the grain of their culture radically and risked everything to follow Christ because they were convinced that it was all true. Some of these people witnessed the risen Christ. They saw him. And it was a dangerous thing to be a Christian. Why else would you be a Christian unless you thought it was really true? And that's the attitude we should have, even those of us who are living in relatively comfortable places, to be a Christian. That's something like the attitude we should try to have. The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15. I just said 2 Corinthians. Sorry. Anyway. He's talking about the resurrection of the dead. And if there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. Skipping ahead to verse 16. For if the dead are not raised, then Christ has not been raised either. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. Then those also who have fallen asleep in Christ are lost. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. This is a glorious chapter on the resurrection, and this is a very dense section, but you could sort of paraphrase Paul by saying, our hope rests completely on the real physical resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, which happened on a particular day in a particular place. And our ultimate hope is that because of this historical event, we too will one day be raised from the dead, literally. And so Paul is saying, don't kid yourselves here. If you deny the truth of these events, your whole faith is a joke. You know, you're just playing pretend. If the resurrection was just a spiritual experience in the hearts of Jesus' followers, that's the way it's explained by many people today. It's the resurrection, sure, it's real, but it's an internal experience of faith in the hearts of Jesus' followers. And everybody knows that it's impossible for someone to get up from the grave, right? But Paul is saying, don't kid yourselves. If that's how you view it, we should just chuck the faith and go. Because this life is all we have. What are we wasting our time for? I quit. So Paul's commitment is first and foremost to the truth of the claims that have been made. He follows Jesus because he's convinced that Jesus is the truth. Another implication, to claim that Christianity is the truth means that we can actually have meaningful discussions about it with other people, even with other people that don't agree with us. Serious discussions about truth and religion should not be off limits if Christianity is the truth. If it is a reasonable thing to believe in what the Bible teaches, then it's a reasonable thing to try to persuade other people as well. If it corresponds to ultimate reality, outside of our heads, then it applies to other people as well as to me. And if the Christian faith really does correspond to what is, to reality, then it should be able to stand up to questions, and it should bear scrutiny. And this does not mean, I'm not trying to make a claim that we can prove the existence of the God of the Bible, or that we can necessarily even offer satisfying rational arguments or explanations for everything in the Christian faith that would satisfy a strict rationalist. I'm not saying that we can necessarily do that, but it does mean that There are good reasons to believe. There is actual evidence for the truth of the Christian faith. And because of that, we can talk about it. And we should be willing to talk about it. It shouldn't be relegated to the sphere of private experience that is meaningful to me, but that I can't really broach with anybody else. Another reason why we can talk openly about Christianity is that it's internally coherent. So I've been talking mostly about sort of the truth of the Christian faith as it stands. But even if someone rejects the truth of the Christian faith, I think there's still a lot to be said for the internal coherence of Christian thought. The Bible tells a story. It may be at times mysterious, it may be at times troubling, but it makes overall sense. Even if we decide that the Bible is nothing more than interesting ancient literature, it is literature that tells a powerful and coherent story, and it holds together, as does the theology that comes from the Bible. It's not just a bunch of disconnected nonsense. Another, and I mean, I'm just moving very quickly here, so every one of these things could be a huge, long discussion. So just forgive me, and there'll be time at the end to pick up with any number of these different things. Another implication, if Christianity is the truth, it means that it is reasonable to say, I don't know, when we really don't know the answer to a question, right? It's a reasonable thing to do that, because it's out of respect for the truth that I say, I don't know. A lot of Christians feel that in order to defend the faith, they have to have an answer for everything, even if they're not really sure about it, or even if they've never really thought about it much before. And that actually does a disservice to the truth. If we actually respect and honor the truth, it should be something we're willing to say, you know what, I'm not sure, but I need to think about that more. And so that's one of the, that is really the best reason to say, I don't know. We say, I don't know around here a lot. I do a lot. And it's always true when I say it. It also means that you may have to be willing to question aspects of what you believe if they don't seem to jive with reality. If we're committed to believing the truth, we might be compelled to, for example, reconsider our interpretation of a biblical text. This kind of openness comes from a commitment to the truth. I want to believe what's really true and what the Bible is really saying. And very often, Christians who really honor the authority of the Bible are compelled to reconsider how they've always interpreted something. And that is, I think, a good and right thing to be open to. I think something we've experienced here at Libri quite a lot is every so often we get young students who come who have grown up in fairly sheltered Christian homes or Christian circles. They've always gone to church. Their parents are Christians. Most of their friends are. They've never had any major doubts or struggles in their faith. And then after a few weeks or maybe even 1 week of being at Libri and being exposed to all kinds of issues and questions that they haven't really thought about much before, it feels like there's a crisis happening for them. And they feel like they're losing their faith. And what's actually happening in many cases is that for the first time they're actually asking the crucial question, is this true? Is this actually really true? Not is it safe or helpful or comforting or familiar or what my parents believe, but is it true? And so very often we try to encourage people that this is not your faith crumbling. This is actually a very important forward step towards maybe having a much deeper faith. But sometimes this takes a long time. So the claim that the Christian faith is the truth, it might be a very basic place to start, I think, but it is in no way obvious or acceptable to many of our neighbors today. That's just an obvious statement. It is an offensive claim, and mostly because of the word the truth. If we claim that it was a truth among other truths, the offense would go away. But when we talk about Christianity being the truth, the implication is that it excludes other claims. And we live in a culture that has by and large accepted religious relativism. Religious relativism is really a way of making sense of all the different beliefs in the world today. And even if people don't articulate exactly what they believe, very often it's something like this. Religion is just fine if you treat it as a personal preference, something that's true for you. And underlying this idea is that when it comes to religious knowledge, no one really can know anything, so no one really has a right to claim they have the one truth that applies to everyone. So each religion is just a different way, in a sense, to the same thing, a different path up the mountain is the image that's often used. If this is what you believe about religion, the idea of persuading someone else to believe what you believe is way out of line. It's arrogant, it's paternalistic, it's an offense. And I read this is, but in many ways, this has been the way many, many people for many years have just thought about religion, in particularly in the West. And there's this horrifying article. Has anyone read this this article in the latest Atlantic? It's called How America Lost Its Mind. Is anybody? I don't agree with everything in the article, but a lot of it is very convincing. It's by Kurt Anderson, who's a NPR radio personality. He says basically we live in an age where it's increasingly okay to make blatantly untrue statements. And that's not just about religious claims anymore, just to say things that everybody has to respect what you believe. It's about things that are actually verifiable, like factual statements. And of course the whole thing builds up to some of the things Donald Trump has been doing and saying. That's sort of the end of the article, but he leads up to it, looking at sort of a history in the U.S. since the 1960s. It's increasingly okay to offer alternative facts, to call anything you don't like fake news, to demand your right to believe anything you want, any conspiracy theory, anything at all. If you feel something strongly enough, you have the right to assert it as a fact. And Kurt Anderson describes this sort of a demand to have your fantasy world respected. And it's the next logical step in American individualism, is what he's saying. This is where American individualism has taken us. Relativism that has dealt with religion in the past has metastasized into the world that everybody agrees is factual, or you know. Anyway, worth a read. Although it's troubling. All this is to say the Christian faith affirms a very different view of the truth. The Bible teaches that the individual is not autonomous to define reality. Reality is something outside of ourselves that we have to come in line with and come in step with. Even when it comes to issues of faith. All right. The supernatural is real. This is theme two. This is quite closely related to the first point, although in some ways it's more practical and less philosophical. This truth we've been talking about is not an abstract idea. To believe in the reality of the supernatural is to acknowledge that there's much that we do not see and understand, much that we cannot see, but which is nonetheless real and has a concrete impact on the world that we do see, on everyday life. The unseen world is a reality. And at the heart of the whole Christian faith, there is a personal God who knows us and wants to be known by us. This God is invisible, but he is no less real than all the things we can see, taste, touch, measure. In fact, he's more real than all those things. It's only in him that all those things have their existence. So he's at work all the time. He sustains all things. Nothing we see around us is automatic. Everything is upheld and sustained by his will. By his providence, he actually is governing history. He's in control of history. We may not understand his providence. We may not be able to have a good explanation for why things happen the way they do, but it is nonetheless a reality. Edith Schaefer had a wonderful image that she wrote about and talked about a lot of a tapestry, a big, ornate, woven piece of fabric on the wall. She said that all of life as we experience it is like looking at the back of the tapestry. So we can make out the vague contours of what the tapestry is about. We can take note of the colors. We can have a vague but at times distorted idea of what the picture looks like on the other side. We see the loose ends of the threads and the places where it's been tied together and all that. Basically the things that the weaver has wanted to hide, right? But supernatural reality is like the front of the tapestry that we cannot actually see right now, but we one day will see more clearly. So we're really looking at a little piece of the back of a tapestry. God's actions in the world are not always easy to explain, particularly when we think about suffering and the reality of evil in the world. But Edith Schaefer reminds us we're actually looking at the back of the tapestry now in a way that one day we will not be anymore. So in the light of supernatural realities, this is how we're supposed to see and interpret all of life, the things we can see, even the ordinary things of life. And so practically, I think what this means is that it's right and proper to pray to God for the very tangible, concrete needs of life. Our prayer should not be limited to big, grand, super spiritual requests. Prayer is a very real connection with a very real God who knows us, and he hears and he responds, not always in the way that we would want him to respond sometimes, but sometimes yes. If we need a job, you pray for a job. That's how real God is. One of Francis Schaeffer's critiques was that many Christians of his day, and we could say the same for today, believe, but they live in unfaith. So practically speaking, they may affirm all the doctrines of the Christian faith, but practically speaking, the ins and outs of daily life, many of us live as if there was no supernatural reality. So we run around, we plan, we make things happen, we stress out, we take control, we micromanage, we lose sight of God's actual presence, his imminence. He's right here with us all the time. He's the one who's actually in control of the world and our lives. So Francis Schaeffer had a crisis of belief. This was some years before starting the Brie, and he asked himself the question, if all the references to prayer and the Holy Spirit were removed from the Bible, would it make any practical difference to his life? And he, after thinking for a while, decided, no, I don't think I would live any differently if there was no mention of prayer in the Bible. And so this was appropriately disturbing to him, and so he really sort of backed up and rethought a lot of how he was living in his faith. And then in the years following that, he and his wife eventually started Le Brie. But Le Brie's policy of not fundraising and not advertising for students was from the beginning, that was a decision they had made, from the beginning an attempt to demonstrate tangibly the reality of prayer. There would be no other way of explaining why this weird organization still exists. That's the idea of living by demonstration. If we don't fundraise, if we don't advertise for students, but we pray for these things and God sees fit to sustain Le Brie, what other reason can we tell the world for why we exist? There is none. It's because prayer is real and God is real. So that's really one of the reasons why we've retained that policy. We call it an institutional weakness. in Le Brie, is to keep grinding our own noses in that reality too, because we forget very, very easily. We start to get into the mindset that we have some great plans and we've got an agenda and God should come along and help us out with this thing, rather than no, this is God's work, and it begins and ends with Him, and we want to be used basically. So we're utterly dependent on God for all things. He's fully able to provide whatever we need, and he will if he wants us to continue. But we need reminding of that all the time, and that's one of the things that's been really, I think, helpful to many people working in Le Brie is that policy of not fundraising, because it sort of forces us to both to pray quite hard. I admit, pray harder when we're low on money, but it sort of forces us into that position of seeing the truth for what it is, that we're dependent. The humanness of spirituality. Spirituality is a human thing. To be spiritual is not to become less human, it's to become more human. And I think this is based on the biblical teachings about creation as well as the incarnation and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. These are all these central aspects of Christian theology, all of which affirm the spirituality of the human. The Bible teaches us that human beings were made, male and female, in the image of God, to resemble God. This means a lot of things, but two main sort of categories that that the image of God means. First, we have intrinsic value and dignity. So if you're a human being, you are the image of God, you have dignity and value by virtue of being human. And secondly, human beings were created with capacities that were like God in many ways. Now those capacities are in many ways are muted or twisted or marred now. But we have the capacity for relationship. We have the capacity for language and symbolic thought. We have the capacity for creativity. All these things we have in common with God, and nothing else in creation has that in common with God. We're persons like God is a person. So God created humans, placed them in the garden to take care of it and to represent Him in the world. And He said that this arrangement was very, very good. Maybe just one very, but very good. Before the fall, there was absolutely nothing wrong with being human. There's no artificial distinction between sacred things and non-sacred things. One of the things that Dickens has often said is Adam and Eve did not partake in any religious activities because all of life was spiritual. All relationships were as they should be at creation. That means fundamentally the relationship between God and people was as it should be. A relationship of harmony and love and openness and submission. Human beings were in their true place as creatures dependent on God. The relationship between people and other people was as it should be. There was nothing twisted and broken about Adam and Eve's relationship. The relationship between a person and themselves was as it should be. They were both whole, coherent people. They weren't fragmented people. And the relationship between people and creation was as it should be. We'll talk a little bit about those things later. But things did not remain so, as you know. We are all sinners now because of the fall, which means that our humanity has been degraded and twisted. It's a little bit like a portrait of somebody that has been scratched up and painted over and defaced in some way. So it's still a masterful portrait, but it's hard to recognize it as such. Schaefer talked about the human being as a glorious ruin. And it might have been he might have been quoting somebody else, I forget who, but there's lots of fun images online if you go looking for glorious ruins or beautiful abandoned spaces. This is just one of them, but I find it's a helpful image to think about. When you think about what a glorious ruin is, it's definitely a ruin. There's no windows in it. There's parts of the walls that are falling down. There's vines growing in, but it's glory. Still, you can still see something of its former glory, right? And one of the aspects of, or maybe a different way of articulating what a glorious ruin is that we are unworthy, but we are of great worth. And that's a very biblical understanding of what a human being is right now. Unworthy, but of great worth. We sin, we're not worthy to be called God's children, but we're of great worth to God. He loves us. He puts a huge value on us. And so it's important not to, I'm talking a little bit more about the glory here, about the spirituality of what it is to be human. Do not forget the glory of what it is to be a human being. There's plenty of ruin, but don't forget the glory. We still have value and dignity, even though we fall short of God's intention for what being a human is. So when somebody does something bad or something they shouldn't, say they get caught cheating on their spouse or they get in a fist fight at a bar or something like that or get drunk or something, we often say, well, they're only human, right? That's an expression we hear. As if having a flawed character is intrinsic to humanness. From the standpoint of Christian theology, I think this is actually a misleading statement. Sin does not demonstrate our humanness. Sin denigrates it. So sin doesn't demonstrate our humanness. Sin denigrates our humanness. We become less human when we sin and rebel against God. So it's true that no one is without sin, but that is not the same thing as saying sinfulness is an intrinsic part of being human. It's not. Sin is a parasitic invader into our humanity. It has seeped into every aspect of our humanity, but sinner and human, by God's standard, is not synonymous. Even though we're all sinners. Does that make sense? I don't know if that... It has a lot to do with God's original intention in creation. This is what a human being was intended to be and will one day be again. So lots and lots of implications of this. One of them is for the Christian view of salvation, how we are saved by God. Salvation does not mean being rescued from our humanness, as if being human was something we needed rescuing from. This would be the ultimate example of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Salvation actually rescues us from the guilt of sin and from death. That's the bathwater. And in so doing, restores our humanity, which is the clean baby. So forgive the trite expression, but the incarnation, which is God taking flesh and becoming a real human being, this speaks volumes about the value God puts on physical, earthy human existence. He embraces it fully in the person of Jesus Christ. In a sense, he redignifies human existence by becoming a man. If we know Jesus, if we put our trust in him, we should never pit spirituality against humanness. Because in a sense, that would be to call Jesus unspiritual. Jesus was fully a human being. He came in order to restore the full image of God. And it's something that only he can do because he himself is the perfect image of God. So on the cross, he takes away the guilt of our sin, gives us his righteousness, and restores the image of God as it is intended to be to us again. Only he could do that, fully God and fully a person. So, to be human is a glorious thing. We have the highest honor and the highest calling in all creation. Despite our sin and our brokenness now, we are not, as some Christian theologians have called us, foul worms. We may be pretty foul in terms of our sin, but in terms of our value, we are not foul worms. We still bear the image of God, and we're waiting to be fully restored through what Christ has done. So some of the implications of this. Self-examination and self-criticism may be very good and necessary for us, but self-hatred never brings us closer to God. Christian spirituality actually affirms the self. And ironically, it affirms the self even as it calls us to self-denial. We actually come closer to our true selves as we abandon our pride and our selfishness and our ambition and the things that actually draw us away from God. This idea of dying to yourself and becoming yourself is a rich part of Christian theology. The spiritual life now is not an attempt to transcend the use of our rational minds either, as if rational thought is only a hindrance to hearing God and letting him work. The mind is a very human thing. God made it. God equipped us with minds. It's a gift from him. We should be using them and doing what we can to sharpen our minds for his glory. So spirituality isn't about denying the value of rational thought. But neither is the spiritual life about denying or suppressing our physical experience either through ascetic practices, the things that many people in the church have practiced, as if the human body is a hindrance to knowing God also. The human body, its desires and its pleasures, is a gift from God to be enjoyed for his glory. Now, obviously, the human body can get us into trouble. Our desires can get us into trouble. But it's always, and then C.S. Lewis is very good on this in the Screwtape Letters, the pleasures are something that God has invented. They lead us into trouble when we enjoy them in an inappropriate way or an inordinate way. But pleasure itself is something that God invented. The devil can't have it. And the devil can't make it either. He can't invent things like that. So the spiritual goodness of sexuality, of good food, of a good night's sleep, the spiritual goodness of longing to be outside in creation, of having a friend, these are very basic things to what it is to be a human being, and they're good. Now, forms of Christianity that have often denied the goodness of the physical body are really influenced more by Platonic thinking, by Plato and some of the people that came after him, than they are the Bible. Biblical Christianity affirms the spiritual goodness of the human body. And the ultimate affirmation of that is the resurrection of Jesus Christ and what it promises for our own future resurrections. So I've been talking about the glory, what it is to be a human being, and now we'll talk a little bit more about the ruin. We live in the shadow of the fall. So when Adam and Eve sinned in the garden, what they were really doing was grasping for godlike authority. Not just for innocent knowledge, but for godlike authority to determine good and evil. And they fell terribly, far below the way they were created in the beginning, and dragged the rest of humanity and the rest of creation down with them. At the fall, and in a really tragic way, I think we see how important the right relationship between humans and God really was. The right relationship between humans and God was very, very important. We were His image, His representatives on earth to the rest of creation. The health of everything in creation depended on our right relationship with God. And so everything was damaged by Adam and Eve's sin. The whole world is now imperfect. All the relationships that were harmonious before, that I mentioned before in creation, became twisted and dysfunctional in some way. So the relationship, the fundamental relationship between God and humans, alienation enters in, fear enters in, hiding, defiance, judgment enter into that relationship. And they were not there before. The relationship between people and other people, into that what was a perfect relationship between people and other people, enters manipulation, blame shifting right away between Adam and Eve, competition, violence, injustice, deception, exploitation, everything that follows, murder within one generation. The relationship between a person and themselves, this internal relationship, we become a mystery to ourselves. We do things we don't understand why we did them. What was I thinking? We become incoherent. We desire one thing and we do the opposite, like Paul talks about. This picture of a fragmentation inside ourselves. We're full of self-doubt. We're full of self-hatred. Or we're full of narcissism and self-worship. All of those are dysfunctional relationships with ourselves. And then the relationship between people and the rest of creation enters domination, where there used to be dominion, exploitation, where there used to be care of creation, degradation, largely caused by human greed. But also, heading in the other direction, there's danger and hardship for people in creation. Creation isn't hospitable for us anymore. Hurricane Harvey, Hurricane Irma. Creation is not intrinsically just fond of us, is it? Creation itself is groaning, and creation is a hard place to be for people. The sweat of his brow, part of the curse in Genesis 3. you'll live, you'll survive, God is with you, but it's not going to be easy anymore. So we see the effects of all these broken and strained relationships everywhere we look. And the Bible teaches us that this brokenness will persist until Christ returns. This is the way things are. This is the state in which we're waiting. There's no avoiding the fall. There's no quarantined space in the world for anyone. Whether we know it or not, whether we believe in God or not, the human heart is sore and bleeding from being cut off from and alienated from its maker. The one who designed us, the one who loved us, the one who knows why we were made. Existence is painful. And the reason this is an important thing to talk about and be aware of is that many people, both Christians and non-Christians, deny this reality in practice. How many times have you heard or even said to yourself, maybe not out loud, but if only I had this job, if only I had this circumstance just right, if I had this spouse, if only I had that house or whatever, then my life would finally sort of click. It would be sorted out. Everything would fall into place. And of course, we can always think of one more thing that would make our lives perfect and bring contentment. One more thing, and we have that, and then we want one more thing that would just somehow make everything easy. Why is everything so hard? And really, this fails to recognize the intrinsic fallenness of the world. No matter what you get, no matter how you succeed, the world is still going to be fallen around you and in you. There's no amount of tweaking that can change this for us. Actually, nothing short of new creation will rid our lives of the fall. But that's what the Bible promises one day, new creation. God's comprehensive undoing of the fall. But none of us can do that. So, no one is immune from the effects of the fall in the world. That's the fall around us. From sickness, depression, heartache, hurricanes, violence, car accidents, abuse, war, PTSD, and eventually death for all of us. There's no guarantee against any of these things. And with death, there's actually a guarantee. But there's also no part of us that is immune from the fall. That means that's the fall within us. There's no part of our humanity which is somehow clean. Each of us is internally corrupted in every part of who we are. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian writer, had this wonderful quote that says, "The line between good and evil runs down the middle of every human heart." So we're never allowed to say, evil is this thing out there, and I'm just basically good in my heart. You know, maybe I make a mistake now and again, but evil is something that I can externalize and remove from myself. No, it's good. The line, there is a line between good and evil, but it goes right down the middle of every person. We're divided. We sometimes talk about pervasive depravity, which means basically that every part of your humanity in some way is twisted by the fall. We're not totally evil. We're not in absolute rebellion against God in every sense. But no part of us is wholly good either. Every part of us is in some way twisted and broken. So we're glorious ruins. This is the ruin part. We're unworthy, but we're still of great worth. And really, the main implication here, there's these two aspects that I've talked about. The fall sort of around us in the world, the things that are out of our control, and the fall within us, our own sin. These things do not change when people become Christians. We are not promised that if we're obedient to God, everything will always go well for us. We'll be happy, well-adjusted, secure, socially at ease, and successful. Read the book of Job. Read the Lament Psalms. Really any place in the Bible. You cannot find that theology. We cannot trace the causes of calamities back to sin in the life of the suffering person. Jesus discourages this directly when he talks about this tower in the town of Siloam that had fallen and killed 18 people. It's in Luke 13. He says, don't think that these people were crushed by the tower because they were worse sinners than anybody else. You know, but you repent. So it's like, no. Don't interpret these things as being God dealing out judgment for people's sin. That's not actually how the world is. But neither, the opposite is true too. Neither is wealth and prosperity a sure sign that you are pleasing God. This is important for Americans to think about. Wealth and prosperity are not sure signs that you are pleasing God. It may be a sign that you are greedy and ungenerous. Psalm 73 is a fascinating psalm. It really begins with the psalmist lamenting the fact that everything the wicked do seems to prosper. Why are they so fat and happy and well clothed? You know, their schemes work. You know, they're doing great. What is going on? And so what is called the prosperity gospel, this sort of teaching that health and wealth awaits the faithful Christian, if only they would just name it and claim it, this kind of teaching that has been prevalent in American Christianity particularly, this is a destructive lie because it claims to give people an out from the fall, usually with techniques to ensure that you have an out. It implies that if hardship actually does come to you, it's because you must not be living faithfully enough. You haven't sold out for Jesus. That's why you're not rich. I'm aware that, and it's something that we should probably grieve more than some of us do, but there's been a lot of bad press for poor old Joel Osteen lately. The megachurch pastor in Houston, who's big on television, he wrote this book called Your Best Life Now. And I'm sorry, but your best life now is not something we should tell people they can realistically have. What does it communicate to a family that's just lost everything in the flood to tell them, you should claim your best life now in 7 steps? You know, this is just, it's just something that a rich person can say to other rich people. It's a denial of suffering, and it leads to callousness, actually. The health and wealth gospel does not prepare Christians to care for others in real crisis, and I think we've seen an example of that in Houston. You're not even really encouraged to think about the fall very much. So, implication. Christians are not immune also from making terrible mistakes. We very often struggle with the very same sins we had before we belonged to Jesus. So this is the fall within us now. We're not suddenly free from our sin. We're free from the guilt of our sin. We're freed by having a clear conscience because of what Jesus Christ has done for us. But we may struggle with the very same things we struggled with before. The Bible does not offer us total victory now. It does offer the possibility of change with God's help now, but it doesn't specify what it looks like and how fast we should expect change to happen. You think of people who struggle, you know, just the example of pornography addiction. Through how many millions of Christians struggle with pornography addiction today. It's something that is very, very hard to kick. And this may be somebody who has fully put their trust in Jesus Christ, and yet, why am I still struggling with this? I'm a Christian, right? And part of this is the reality of the fall that hasn't sunken in. There may be some things we struggle with our whole lives. And the Bible doesn't promise that kind of final victory right now. It does promise final victory. It promises God's grace in the meantime. It's Paul's language in Philippians 2 of pressing on towards this goal. He knows what the goal is, that he's going to be like Christ fully, but he's not there yet, and he doesn't expect to be there in his own power in this life. But he knows what he will become, and that gives him strength to press on with all his strength, knowing that God is in him. And so, it's wonderful language that should be encouraging to us. Another implication, and this is a very important one as we look at history, particularly the 20th century, but in many places in history, utopias do not exist. No amount of political fine-tuning and cultural change will ever bring about a society that is free from the fall. Many people have pointed out that most of the carnage and bloodshed of the 20th century, whether it was under Hitler, under Lenin, under Stalin, under Mao Zedong, under Pol Pot in Cambodia, almost all of it was motivated by some kind of utopian vision of progress. Now, there were different utopian visions in different cases, but the result was pretty much the same. Brutality and mass murder. Why? Well, because every utopian vision fails to recognize that the world is inherently, unavoidably broken. Instead, utopianism is the belief that society is perfectible given the right laws, the right conditions, the right genetics, the right restrictions on humanity. It's perfectible. We can do it. And so when obstacles arise to that perfect vision in the form of real people, the utopian government must eliminate them to keep the dream alive, to keep the vision alive. And so whole people groups tend to get wiped out in the name of the progress towards this future perfection. In the case of Hitler, it was to rid the gene pool of Jewish genes and others. Gertrude Himmelfarb had a wonderful quote that I think is a paraphrase maybe, but she said, "Utopia is rejecting the good in the name of the best and getting the worst." So the same dynamic, I think, is at play on a much smaller scale, on a less destructive scale, in community life. This is something we talk about a lot at Labrie, life in community. What does Christian community mean? What does it look like? The book Life Together by Dietrich Bonhoeffer is a wonderful, very insightful discussion of Christian community. He argues that in Christian communities that are built on the wish dream of a leader, in other words, their sort of miniature utopian vision, the wish dream, that leader often becomes tyrannical, judgmental, because no one can measure up to his vision for the community. Instead, for a community to be Christian, says Bonhoeffer, the wish dream has to be put to death, and in its place there has to be a disillusionment. There's a disillusionment which has to take place, and it's a healthy disillusionment with each other, but also with ourselves, acknowledging our sin, acknowledging each other's sin, doing away with the naive notion that we can somehow live perfectly in harmony in our own strength. The sooner that happens, he says, the better it is for the community, the less damage we'll do expecting everyone to be perfect. And the sooner we do that, the sooner we experience that disillusionment with ourselves and each other, we can actually see that Christ alone is the thing that unites the Christian community. It's what we have in common by being washed by the blood of Christ that unifies us. It's not being good people. It's not a common concern for some particular issue. It's none of those things. It's Christ. So, Life Together is a good and thankfully fairly short read. You should read it. So you can see that to not have a firm belief in the fall is actually really dangerous. The fall is something that's essential to Christian theology. When we don't have a robust theology of the fall, it's dangerous. And while the fall itself is obviously not good news, I think to have a strong theology of the fall is actually an encouragement in life. That sounds paradoxical, maybe. But it's a freeing thing to believe in the fall. It means you can stop pretending that everything is okay when it's obvious that everything's not okay. It gives a context for processing, maybe not understanding everything, but processing the harsh realities that we see around us every day. It gives us a context. Because the doctrine of the fall shows that evil is real, but not part of God's original intent for the world, we actually have grounds to resist the effects of the fall everywhere we look. We actually have something to push back against. But we do not have to labor under the pressure that it's all up to us to rid the world of evil. And that's clearly God's job. You see in the Gospels, I think particularly in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus coming, it's this amazing foretaste of what will totally be fulfilled one day, but Jesus comes and immediately begins pushing back the effects of the fall everywhere. He's confronting things that are unjust. He's healing people who are sick. He's casting out demons. He's speaking the truth into corrupt situations. Everything about what he's doing is pushing back the effects of the fall, and he has the authority to do it. And that's what we're anticipating will one day finally be complete when Christ returns and the effects of the fall will finally be undone entirely. We are supposed to be resisting the fall everywhere in our lives, but never with the delusion that we're going to bring an end to it ourselves. It's wonderful. It reminds me of the hymn, "The Joy to the World," which is written by Isaac Watts, 18th century English hymn writer. This line is, "He comes to make his glories known far as the curse is found." So the curse is found everywhere in creation. Christ's coming makes God's glories known as far as the curse is found. Every nook and cranny that the fall has corrupted will one day be undone. So, believing in the fall allows, I think, for the possibility of redemption. Because we acknowledge a problem, and then we can begin to be open to the solution that God has provided. So, we save ourselves a lot of pain and disillusionment if we accept that we're living in the shadow of the fall all the time. Given all this, Christians have no excuse for being sentimental. Christians are known for being sentimental. But we don't have any good excuse for being sentimental. We should be the first to mourn evil, to recognize evil, to mourn it. We should be the most eager of any people to resist it. We should be the least naive about human nature. And we should be the least shocked of all people when evil things happen. We should grieve it, but we shouldn't be shocked. That's not to say that horrible things are never shocking to Christians. They are, but we should be prepared for the fact that evil is real and these things are happening. Lastly, the lordship of Christ over all of life. And there are, this is something that Dick has lectured on a lot and expanded on, obviously much more than I can do tonight, but this is something that we talk about so much on the Brie, and it's such a good and a life-giving thing to talk about and to reflect on. There's two aspects of the statement. When you say Jesus Christ is Lord over all of life, there's the Lord part, what does that mean? And then there's the all of life part, what does that mean? And they're not completely separable. You can't really put them in different boxes, but I'll talk about them separately a little bit. What does it mean that Jesus is Lord? I'll just throw out a couple of great biblical one-liners. In Matthew 28, this is at Jesus' ascension, and it's the scripture that's known as the Great Commission, when he tells his disciples to go out and baptize people in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teach people to obey all his commands. But before he says that, and in a sense his grounds for being able to say that, is this: all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. It's quite a big claim. Paul in Philippians 2 says, at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth. And in Colossians 1, I decided to put this up here for you to reflect on and look at. This is one of the most of comprehensive declarations of Christ's supremacy, his lordship. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. It's glorious. Declaration of who Jesus is. That I don't even know how many times he says all things, but it's a lot. Again and again and again. Through Jesus, all things were made. All things were made for him. This idea that creation is and humanity is Jesus' inheritance for him. Jesus' lordship means that he really is the supreme ruler of everything, the one and only Son of God who became man, who suffered, who died, who rose again, and ascended into heaven. He is even now at the right hand of God, at the helm of the universe, essentially. Heaven is what N.T. Wright has called the control room of the universe, basically. That's one of the ways in which we should think of heaven, at the control room of the seat of authority. And there's no limit to his authority. His kingship is legitimate. He's not a usurper. And he's not a local ruler of some kind or other, among others. He's the Lord over every other Lord. And the nations are in his inheritance. So, in other words, he deserves our absolute allegiance. He's not making an egotistical claim on us. He's making a reasonable, appropriate claim on us when he says, you must obey me. So, we can hold nothing back from him legitimately. So, his lordship, that's about the sort of weight and depth of his authority. It's absolute. But then there's the second part, the all of life part. He's Lord over all of life, or Lord of all of life. And this is more about the breadth of his authority, the scope and diversity of things that he rules over. You could put it that way. Because Jesus is Lord over all reality, he is to be honored in every part of our lives. Not just in one compartment of our lives, like the churchy bit of our lives. Because every part of my life belongs to him, every endeavor is an opportunity for obedience to him. It all belongs to him. And this is a radical thought. But the key here, and I think one of the main reasons why we end up discussing this a lot at Le Brie, is that because every part of human life belongs to Jesus, it gives every part of human life value. And a lot of the Reformed theologians in the Protestant Reformation were very helpful in developing this idea, the lordship of Christ over all of life and the value of all the things that humans do. That's not that it was a totally new thought, but they really developed it and it became part of the church's thinking. If Jesus is Lord over your family matters. If Jesus is Lord over your sexuality matters. If he's Lord over your money matters. If he's Lord of literature and art, then literature and art matter. If Jesus is Lord over all creation, then the oceans and the forest and the mountains and everything else in them matters. You go on. All work, all human work that isn't outright rebellion against God. Politics, medicine, plumbing, international relations, city planning, forestry, farming, the law, journalism, novel writing, waste management, education, all the sciences, whatever, just keep going. All these things matter. The grand and the mundane tasks of every day are significant, all because they belong to him. So Abraham Kuyper has a famous quote he gave in one of his lectures on Calvin's theology, and it's often quoted. There is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. There's not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. And so, given who Christ is, this is not an unreasonable thing. Everything is his. I hear this as a joyful, affirming mine. That's good news. You know, it's Christ to whom all these things belong. It's not a bratty sort of mine, you know. You need to hear the right tone of voice. One of the reasons, I think, why we talk about the lordship of Christ so much at Le Brie is that many Christians have lost sight of the all of life part of Jesus' lordship, that second part of that idea. In the minds of many Christians, and I think, as far as I know, in this country particularly, but maybe in other places as well, there is a stark division between the sacred and the secular. a split between those two ideas. All of life is divided into these two categories. Things are either sacred or they're secular. And there are certain areas of life, certain activities, certain pastimes, certain books, certain vocations, that are automatically more spiritual than others. These are the sacred things, and these are the things that really matter to God. Church, Bible study, missions work, evangelism, and prayer, to name a few. And the image that that's helpful to me to think of in your mind in terms of explaining this idea, this split between the sacred and the secular. And I'm explaining this now, but this is a problem. This is not actually what I'm rooting for here. but I'm trying to explain it first. There's this pyramid, and to make Jesus Lord of all of life is simply to put these things in the top triangle. Prayer, Bible study, church, missions, evangelism. Put those things in the place of priority in your life. Make those the most important things to you. Prioritize the explicitly Jesus-y things. I need to make church, Bible study, prayer, evangelism, missions work, pastoral ministry the most important things to me. I should pour all of my time and my energy and my money and my talents into these things. I should try to enjoy these things more than anything else, because these are the sacred things. Now, the secular category is made up of literally everything else in the world. These are the things that are not important or as important to God, things we should consider distractions or obstacles to the truly spiritual life. And there's some gradations, so maybe it's more spiritual to be in service work, to be helping people, to be serving the poor, something like this. These are pretty spiritual maybe, but not as spiritual as the things at the top of the pyramid, right? So to care much at all about current films, about scientific discoveries, about business practices, about medicine, about politics, about the environment, is spiritually speaking a waste of time. It's failing to make God number one in your life. I heard a sermon by a youth pastor quite a few years ago when we lived in Vancouver. And I think he had a bee in his bonnet because a bunch of his kids from his youth group had missed a Bible study because they were on a hockey team. This is Canada. And he really railed against them in this sermon. And what he kept saying over and over again is that we have the choice between giving our time and our energy to eternally significant things or just following pursuits. And that was a dirty word to him. Pursuits. You know, like, why are you so stupid as to follow the pursuits when you're, it's as if you're sort of playing with your eternal soul. And you go to the hockey game instead of to your Bible study, which maybe you've been to every other night, and you're just wasting your spiritual life. And it was one of the most, extreme kind of examples of the sacred secular, split that I had heard, and I came away very disturbed, and I realized, man, this is a different theology than I've grown up hearing. Just pursuits, you know. So, this sacred-secular divide has a lot of bad consequences, and I'll just talk about a few. It impacts how people view their own value and their gifts. So, if I am a creatively gifted person and I make art, and this is what gives me joy, this is not a spiritual thing to do, but if I really must, the art better be all about Jesus. How else could I justify it? If art is a means to an end of evangelizing, then maybe it's okay. This is maybe a strong opinion, but usually that makes for bad art and bad evangelism. It impacts decisions about vocation, and I've talked, and many of us have probably talked to people who are convinced that they were called to be pastors or missionaries, not because they were particularly gifted in those areas at all, but because they had always been told that these were the spiritual things to do. And unless you did these things, you kind of fell off the boat. If you know you're not gifted to be a pastor, then you feel like a spiritual failure. For those people who end up working in quote-unquote non-spiritual jobs, and that's with quotes for those of you who are not in the room now, non-spiritual jobs, the workplace can become simply a field to do kingdom work. So it's an opportunity for evangelism only. Talking to people about Jesus can become more important than the quality of one's work. And again, it ends up being a poor witness to Jesus Christ, who actually wants us to do good work. Overall, it leaves people with a narrow and shrunken experience of the world. It limits the impact that Christians have in places where Christians are desperately needed. You think of Christians in medicine or science or the arts or politics or education. The world desperately needs Christians in these areas. Worst of all, the sacred secular divide expels Jesus Christ from most of the areas of our life where he actually belongs. And so while the pyramid appears to make Jesus really, really important, it actually excludes him from every other part of life, from the whole base of the pyramid. And so a better image, which I think it does, I mean, no image is perfect, but it does more justice to the lordship of Christ, is just a very big circle. The circle contains all the things that Jesus actually cares about. Christians should feel a freedom to engage with any or all of these things, depending on their gifting, the opportunities that God gives them, any specific guidance that God gives them as well. To be a plumber is not less spiritual an endeavor than to be a pastor. Sometimes it's a lot more useful to be a plumber. To do the dishes, this is an example that my dad has often said. One time a student, after hearing some of these thoughts, came up to him and said, do you really mean to say that it's as important to do the dishes as it is to pray? And the answer is, well, if it's your turn to do the dishes and the dishes need to be done, yes, it's actually more spiritual to do the dishes than to pray. If you use prayer as an excuse to avoid dishwashing, it's not spiritual. All right, you students, you got that? the distinction should that concern us is not between the sacred and the secular. The distinction that could concern us is between spiritual things and sin. So sin is the only non-spiritual thing, and that is outside this circle. Now, I'm not trying to imply that sin never plays a part in any of these areas. We just talked about the fall for a long time. Every one of these areas is infected by human sin. But that is not to say that these areas are intrinsically unspiritual. Sin has crept into them because people are sinful. But Jesus Christ values each one of these things. Playing with your kids, time with your friends, politics, biology, the arts, church ministry, doing the dishes. So, we don't have the luxury of caring only about some things. Christians should care about everything. The exhortation to take every thought captive to Christ is one of these massive, challenging things in the Bible. What would it mean for every thought to be captive to Christ? So, I think this is a profoundly freeing and even exhilarating theology. I'm so glad it's true, that we can honor our Maker by doing any number of different things in the world and offering it to Him. We can do everything to the glory of God. Eat, sleep, work, raise children, go to church, make friends, grow vegetables, vacuum the hallway. All these things are potentially spiritual when offered to the Lord. Just going to conclude. I think each one of these, I'm not going to attempt to sort of tie this all together into one comprehensive statement, because I don't know how to do that. But each theme sort of encompasses a lot, but there is a flow from one to the next, I think. They're coherent with each other. This is part of the internal coherence of the Christian faith I was talking about earlier. Christianity corresponds to what is. The unseen world is real, and it's connected to the world we see. It's spiritual to be human, and yet all of life is twisted by the fall, including ourselves. But because he is Lord over everything, everything matters. Even so, there's many, many things and important things that I've left out of this talk that are not themes of Libri. And it's not because they're not important. It's because these are the things that we have ended up talking about a lot. I haven't mentioned anything about community and hospitality, really. We haven't talked about the atonement or the role of the Holy Spirit or the power of forgiveness. I mean, these are all equally central to the Christian faith. And so please don't hear my exclusion of those things as a statement that they're less important. But these things, these themes are really connected insofar as they've been thinking that we have done in response to a particular need. Each of them addresses an area where Christians and the church has really struggled or failed. And a lot of the misunderstandings around these ideas have been destructive in the church. So that's where I am going to end. And thank you for your patience. Anybody has any questions or comments or things they want to respond to? This is a time when we open it up for discussion, and we'll go for a while. And if you have to leave, that's fine. You can go ahead without offending anybody. But anybody have any responses or questions? We'll go back to the Colossians text. Oh. This could be early night. Sir.
I was just going to sort of, I'd like to mine the room for collective wisdom on how to keep giving yourself this good antidote to the sacred secular divide that that is not true, that Christ really is Lord over all of these things. When you see that continuing to crop up in your own life, here I am, I work in Liberty, I believe this, but I feel like some things matter and some things don't.
Mm-hmm.
Some things matter more, some things matter less. Mm-hmm. But this day was a great day, this day was not, because this was more significant, this was less. You know, that kind of split is hard to deal with. So I'm just curious. I'm cognizant of that when it's there, but I'd love to know if people have ways of dealing with that.
Any thoughts?
Can I add to her problem? I've been reading in preparation for my talk on Luther's view of how Luther transformed marriage, reading about Martin Luther and Catherine of Anjou's marriage. And also thinking of Tim Keller's book on prayer, where he talks about Martin Luther praying for 4 hours a day. And he evidently, during his most productive time, wrote something like 200 pages of books, manuscripts, every 2 weeks.
Surely that's when he was single, right?
And he insisted that he really, really encouraged Catherine and his wife to read the Bible, which she did with great. He had a wife who was running this massive household with all his students and their six children and their nieces and nephews and her aunt and their whole Reformation theology was that all of that is spiritual, all of life is spiritual, and yet I totally feel what Sarah is saying is that if I don't have time to pray for 4 hours a day to make the problem worse. I've been thinking about it with respect to Luther's marriage.
Yeah.
Like,
And this doesn't mean, just to clarify a couple things, it doesn't mean that we should necessarily expect, but even if we have this theology that all these things are significant to Christ, it doesn't mean that we should expect to have a great attitude that all we do is change diapers and haven't managed to pick up a book for weeks. There's frustrations in life, even though changing diapers is a spiritual endeavor, you know. It is possible, I suppose, to fall off the other end of the roof and be like, oh, it's so great, like I can do anything and Jesus is happy with me, you know, I can just go for a walk instead of reading my Bible. Well, very often we do all kinds of things to avoid praying. and we really need to pray. And so I don't want anything that I've said to sound like I'm saying that, you know, that I am taking prayer and Bible study and church involvement down some notches by elevating these other things. I'm saying, no, a lot of it has to do with just the wisdom of how we use our time and trying to make decisions about how we use our time, holding on to our theology as hard as we can. This is the time for me to do the dishes and not to read the Bible. This is the time for me to read the Bible and not do the dishes. The spirituality is sort of how we make that decision in the moment.
What I find helpful, just as a way to start to get this, really what you were just saying, but in different words, what's the matter with the sacred secular business is to say that prayer is intrinsically more valuable and spiritual than washing dishes.
Automatic, yeah.
And to think of these things being intrinsically themselves more mm-hmm. valuable than others on your pyramid,
mm-hmm.
That's what's not true. Mm-hmm. If prayer is always intrinsically more spiritual, you become a Platonist. If mm-hmm. dishwashing is always intrinsically more spiritual, you become a Marxist. Neither of these are worried about. So that sometimes it's definitely more mm-hmm. spiritual to wash dishes, and sometimes it's definitely more spiritual to pray.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a question of what's going on in life, but mm-hmm. we don't want to battle against this intrinsic value placed on these activities, which I think is mm-hmm. a huge help mm-hmm. anyway.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What's in your lap wisdom?
Which just to add what Dick is saying, that this doesn't take away from our need to set priorities, mm-hmm. to think about what we've been called to do,
mm-hmm.
and to pray prayerfully each day, seek to know what God has for us to do and try to do it for Him.
Yeah.
And also our limitations.
Mm-hmm.
One of us who knew Mrs. Schaefer well, mm-hmm. this was the biggest struggle of her life. She mm-hmm. wanted to do everything really well, and just drove herself crazy sometimes because of that. But
and a lot of people,
some of the other people who spent time with her.
A lot of people have driven themselves crazy trying to be just like her too.
It's one of the most wonderful things about them. How much they knew their weaknesses and how open they were about them. But we struggle with our finiteness,
mm-hmm.
And we still need to really carefully go into each day mm-hmm. and help me do the things that I really need to do today.
Because
we can't do it all.
And some of it, I think, has to do with trust in God. Like, okay, I'm not, I haven't somehow fallen out of God's will irrevocably. If I, you know, whatever, I'm stressed out and go for a walk instead of reading my Bible or whatever.
It's also it's helpful to think about this realistically, because I was thinking, if everything is equally spiritual and important in different times, but if we expect to feel just as alive and happy and fulfilled changing a diaper as we are writing a lecture that we're excited about giving or something, mm-hmm. it might not actually be like an accurate or necessary expectation of everything.
Yes.
Provides the same feeling of satisfaction the moment.
That's exactly what I was trying to say a minute ago. We can say these things have value, but we shouldn't expect to always be.
Enjoy the
I was just thinking of like for you, sir, not to put you on the spot, but like I just know you're really good at speaking and teaching, so it makes sense that you would have to constantly like when I'm not able to do that, like then what does it mean to be joyful, or this is meaningful and I'm doing this or that, it's not as life-giving, but I don't know that it would like mean it immediately that you're actually just not like valued as
I think with parenting, so much of what we do is just responding to immediate needs. From one to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, we're just like, you know, I don't feel like I'm even deciding anything, you know. We're just like putting out fires and plugging holes and like, anyway.
I was just thinking too of how, weeding your garden, fighting the woodchuck that has been getting into my garden and eating everything in my garden. The woodchuck in my garden and the weeds are part of the fall, but weeding them and trying to get rid of them is spiritual work. That's a really, or thinking of Taylor, who's in the military. The fact that we need a military is because of the fall, because there are wars, because we have to protect ourselves, because we sometimes have to protect other innocent people. But all of life's lordship over this fallen world means good thing. There are people who it's spiritual work to learn to fly a helicopter, to do. So that's the intersection.
And it's sure is spiritual to know how to do it right.
Absolutely.
If you're in the helicopter, you know.
Exactly. But also, Lindy's word, the little word that she had in there, your calling. That's a huge thing.
Yeah.
What is the shape of my vocation? Now in this chapter of my life, and it's not going to be the same.
Even this moment.
Life comes in chapters, and vocation. I think the Puritans had a really good, broad, biblical understanding of what vocation is. It doesn't just mean we think of vocational training. It's about your job training. Vocation is the whole shape of your life, the whole shape of your calling at any point. And if you're a mother of small children, a father of small children, a parent of small children, a large part of your vocation is caring for those children, putting out the fires you're talking about, changing diapers, potty training Lily.
Spiritual.
Vocation, having a sense. I remember when Dick was working on his first book, Beyond Identity. He had three little kids. And it took him a really long time to write his first book. And if someone had the view that your vocation is you're a spiritual leader, you're preaching and writing, and that's your vocation. Your children are paper. Your children are a drag on your vocation. That's a totally wrong view of what his vocation is. His vocation involved every aspect. He was pastor of a church. He was a livery worker. We had a church and a livery in our home. He was father of three young children. He was a husband to me.
And he could do a bit of writing on the side.
And he was writing books that he really believed God, and that God has used this book, Beyond Identity, for years ever since. But it just took a lot longer than if he was single and had a maid. he was doing all the stuff for him. And in fact, in the end, he got it done because some dear friends of ours, farmer and his wife, invited him out to stay on their farm, and they basically cooked for him and then fed him and then sent him back to his desk until he could finish it. Because when he was home with all the other parts of his vocation, it would have taken even longer. But having that vision rather than the frustration of I can't. And that is really, this will come up a lot in our Reformation thing. This was something that the Reformation
rediscovered about the Bible, which was not true in the medieval church, mm-hmm. where the idea was marriage, children, family life is completely at odds with the life of a theologian and a scholar. Mm-hmm. And that's why the celibacy of priests was so important, because they should not be married. They can't do God's work. They're mm-hmm. hampered with babies befouling the corners mm-hmm. of the
That's Luther's language, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of it has to do with what we view as interruptions, and in a sense, that broader view of vocation or calling as being your whole, the shape of your whole life. Then instead of
Now instead of interruptions, after all this time working at Notre Dame, the interruptions were really the thing.
That was the vocation. And we get into real trouble if we feel entitled to our time and entitled to time to write and entitled, like, this is mine. Because as we feel, the more entitled we feel to something, the more aggrieved we feel when those things are taken away. And so that's a big part. I mean, anybody, I think, but we certainly experience that in the Brie. The interruptions are the work, or part of the work. So it's not as if I'm trying to work on this lecture and someone keeps coming and asking me how to start the weed whacker. You know, that's the work too. That's, you know, this is all. anyway, yeah. Kevin.
I just feel like I've heard a couple of sermons out of Genesis 22, and mm-hmm. I think for me, part of it too is this constant. Like, I constantly want to tell myself that work is the result of the fall, mm-hmm. but that mm-hmm. like, we were created for work. We were created to bring order out of mm-hmm. chaos. Like, mm-hmm. when God put Adam and Eve in the garden, like, there was work.
Yeah.
Where I think we sort of think of it like, you think, and popular culture sort of makes Eden this sort of like carnival cruise line. Mm-hmm. And then there was the fall and there was work, right?
Right, yeah.
So,
the distinction between.
That, like, blows over into everyday life. Like, I don't know how to motivate, like, that sort of a meta level.
Yeah.
I don't know how you, like, distill that there. You can say, like, oh, I'm sure.
I think there's things that we have to do now that we never would have had to do in the fall, certainly. But there's also a different attitude we have towards those things.
Cubicles.
The distinction isn't between leisure before the fall and work after the fall. The distinction is between work before the fall and toil. After the fall. Work becomes drudgery and onerous and at times futile. We see our work undone. Why did I spend all day doing this? This is a total waste of time. And then also, of course, our sin impacts how we view work as well. I get angry about having to do something that's a perfectly good thing to do, and I should stop feeling sorry for myself. I think the toil, having a renewed imagination for what really, for the goodness of work, I think is important, because maybe it's difficult to do that if our work happens to be really not very fulfilling but work itself is good, and it's significant that God places Adam and Eve in the garden, and it's not finished. Like, there isn't a quote unquote Greek kind of concept of perfection, a static, everything is perfect, so don't touch anything. It's a Hebrew vision of goodness and wholeness and room for development. Things are as they should be, but human beings were made to change things and to experiment and to make things and combine things that weren't together before, and so that's really the sort of realm of human dominion. So work is absolutely a good thing, but I think we've lost an imagination for what that might be or look like. I think. Dick, did you have something you want to say?
Another thing, getting back to Sarah's query, we've seen here that the sacred secular thing, depending on how we've learned it, can really get under our skin in a deeper way than you ever imagined. Mm-hmm. An example that really blew me away was a guy who was here who was very much into that. He had not been allowed, his family had been allowed to watch television but never go to the cinema. Okay? You may have heard me tell the story. Three years before he came here, he had had that theology changed and was open to, he knew that wasn't wrong to go to a cinema. Mm-hmm. But he'd never been to a cinema. He'd never actually gone to a movie theater. And
Theoretically, okay.
It often happens in the three. Other students took him in hand and make sure that he got to the cinema and actually experienced it. Well,
we're going to do this.
He did, and he had actually a panic attack in the cinema. Mm-hmm. In Framingham, mm-hmm. right here in Framingham. Mm-hmm. The first time he'd ever been in one. And they all had to leave for his sake to get out. Mm-hmm. And that's so sad. Because for 3 years, he changed his theology, and this was no longer a problem for him. Mm-hmm. But somehow it was under his skin and his bones or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. So that it was just guilt and horror. The roof may cave in, it may start on fire, mm-hmm. the whole theater.
And it will be the judgment of God.
Yeah. And so it's not just an idea to change.
Yeah.
It is that, but it's an idea that has enormous sort of staying power. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you have something?
Yeah, just kind of building on the discussion. I think when you're talking about how Christ has dominion over all, like no matter what we do mm-hmm. in society. Toying with the idea of like what it really does mean to glorify God, I think mm-hmm. like the end state mm-hmm. of man, like glorify God and enjoy Him forever. And mm-hmm. so I think a lot of times I focus on, oh, if I'm doing like, you know, God's work, then mm-hmm. it's like I'm glorifying Him. But mm-hmm. could you say to start to get at the idea like this really like to glorify God, to be fully human? Would you say?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I've never really thought of it or conceived of it that way.
Yeah.
Because I thought like, oh, it must be like what I do or. Mm-hmm. Like what can I do like to evangelize or always mm-hmm. share Jesus or everything I have to do always like you're saying mm-hmm. like almost like a means to an end, like mm-hmm. well if I'm in this job then it's a good. I mean we say that at West Point all the time, even in the Christian community, like the army is a huge mission field, which mm-hmm. you know isn't inherently wrong, but it does kind of use the idea of the military for almost like forced ends, whereas mm-hmm. like well being an army officer can just be my worship. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So mm-hmm.
And to do it well.
Right.
And do it in a way that respects the image of God and other people.
Right.
And I mean, these are all part of what glorifying God in that work would look like. Mm-hmm. Being responsible, being competent, being all those things. Not just being sure to talk about Jesus with everybody. That may be a very good and appropriate thing to do.
Right.
At various times, but not if it's all viewed as a means to that end. Right. Because I think the Lord wants us to do good work. Mm-hmm. And it's actually not honoring Him. We may think it is, but it's not honoring Him to neglect some aspect of our work or to not care about quality.
Right.
In the name of doing evangelism or something. That, mm-hmm. That's actually, now who knows, God can use any number of different things. And, mm-hmm. But I've seen and certainly heard of lots of examples in which that has not been a terribly good witness to the truth of the Christian faith. Like, why is this person neglecting their work, and why is everything they do shoddy, mm-hmm. and yet they're telling me about Jesus all the time? This is not what we want. This is not what we want to be presenting as the truth of the Christian faith. We want to, I think, we're called much more to be living in a way that is excellent and honorable, mm-hmm. and have people wonder why is it that person is that way, right? and talk to people in that context. We're much more likely to have something to say that they'll listen to, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And again, this is not that you shouldn't view your work as in part an opportunity to talk to people about the truth of the Christian faith. But if it's the viewing it as a means to an end, which I think is dishonoring to God. And the same would go for any number of different things. Like art, I mentioned art is one, but it could be any different kind of work.
Yeah, it really helped me to think about it.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Yeah, Lenny.
Just to add to that, I grew up with that kind of theology. Mm-hmm. The chief end of man was to witness. And it occurred to me, you know, as I was supposedly growing out of this and changing my view, that, you know, this view is, like what you're saying, is witness toward what end?
Mm.
If we want to, the whole point is to bring people into a fuller kind of life that involves everything. Adam and Eve, if there hadn't been a fall, there wouldn't have been any witnessing.
Right.
That kind of witnessing.
Right,
Jesus is your Savior. And here's how he can become it. Your Savior. It's just living the fullness of life. That he's provided for us, doing what he's given us to do, you know, to work and enjoy his creation and cultivate what he's given us to cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea that, you know, witness is an end in itself, like you say, just, you know, there's, so what are you bringing these people into?
Right, right, right. What are you witnessing to? And if that is, if you do,
there's going to be something going on among all of us that's attractive.
Yeah,
it's the way life is supposed to be.
Yeah. The chief end of humanity is to witness, so that we can have more people to witness. But if that's really the chief end of how you view your life, then you're not going to be living. You're not going to be living in a way that necessarily appeals. Mary Frances first.
I was going to say, that connects back to, I think, to having a robust theology of the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think what we tend to hear about is like, well, what's the result of the fall? Man was separated from God.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus came, and we have to witness to people so that they have union with God again, and they are saved. Mm. And all of that is true. But it's just a piece of the story. But the fall wasn't... the result of the fall is also that we have broken relationships with one another.
Right.
We have broken relationship with ourselves. We have broken relationship with creation. We have, you know, like, Jesus came to restore all of that, to restore the fullness of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Versus like, well, what happened in the fall is this kind of separation from God. And so... why we're here is to, you know, but that's, and that's true. It's not untrue, but it's just one wedge of the pie.
Yeah.
In a way. And I feel like that's something that I didn't hear, or if I did, I wasn't paying attention. Didn't really hear that talked about a whole lot before I came to agree. It just wasn't something I heard, even if people believe it, it wasn't really talked about in that way in the church or Christian communities or whatever. It's just been helpful.
Marty?
Yeah, it also relates, this is just showing how all your points here sort of relate together, but to the problem of if people have the idea that if I'm a really serious Christian, I'll be, and all serious Christians will become pastors or missionaries or something. And rather than recognizing that God has different vocations for all of us, that he wants Christians in every part of life being the best, being really good journalists, being really good, you know, at whatever we're doing. But because then you have that same thing that Lenny said, well, what are people being saved to? If all the serious Christians are pastors at churches, but it's not going down into
all the congregants must not be serious Christians.
I remember we had a many years ago we had a woman who was a journalist here, TV. I think she worked in television, and I was just really respected what she said, because she got some pushback from various students saying, oh, how can you be, she was the only Christian in her whatever, I can't remember if it was a newspaper or was it a television thing, but she described how she had a, just how she prayed for God to use her to be salt and light in her field, and she didn't have all, you know, total freedom to do anything she wanted, but she could choose what stories to report on, you know, what to write about, and the way she described it was a really good example of the way in which salt, being salt and light, salt slows down decay. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, we're blessed to be part of a real revival, you know, a revival that changes our whole culture. But sometimes faithfulness to God means where our work is slowing down the decay of the culture, but otherwise it'd be decaying faster. And she was...
Doesn't have as much of a ring to it, does it?
No. She was able to tell stories in a way that, rather than just thrashing human beings,
she
compared her stories with other stories which are really just cynical about human beings and just looking for dirt. And and she wasn't sentimental, but you could see how she really... really spoke and said, this is my calling, and this is how I can be salt and light. This is how I can show something of God's truth and the stories I choose to report on and the way I tell them. And it, you know, it's not causing a revival, but it is shedding both light and slowing down some decay. And that was glorifying God.
It was helpful to see the pyramid that you did and to realize how this sacred divide, it helps place a context for why sometimes when I tell a specifically Christian person that I am doing hospice social work or any other kind of social work for that matter, why the question they sit on the side is like, oh, I bet that's a great place you get to share your faith, right? And they never would ask, like, oh, I bet that's just great to be able to help people talk through their life. Or, oh, man, I guess that must be a blessing to get to just show someone their human dignity and worth or whatever. Anyway.
You're saying you do not hear those kinds of things as much from you.
I don't hear those things as usually hear from certain persons. But not all. I usually hear something about, like, oh, so do you get a chance to talk about Jesus or your faith or something? And my answer is, like, yeah, I definitely do. But when I think about the work that I do sometimes, I think, I'm not sure, but I think that the moments when I am able just to look someone in the eyes who will be gone soon and say something about, like, yeah, you are important for every day that you're alive, for however long you have. I want you to remember that, because a lot of times the nursing home did for that, because I feel like it's good. And usually there's, like, this... it seems like spiritual work. Like, it seems like there's something connects there. And I think that's a specifically, like, Christian belief that has, like, deep roots, that this person is a human being of value.
Image of God.
Maybe just as much as if I were to say something about, you know, the separation between them and God or something, which may or may not even be the situation.
If that
came up and was appropriate, maybe I would say something about that. Maybe I'm less equipped to say something about that. I don't know.
You're...
I'm very helped by this sort of look at it, because it gives weight to every part of of, like, what I would do as a social worker, including the fact that I may have made a referral to them, get some meals come into the house. You had earlier on a screen that, like, good food is okay. So maybe that's just as important as what I said or didn't say about
That's another example where your wisdom in the moment is really the key. What does this person actually need? What is God calling me to say? I think that's a particularly excellent thing to say to someone who's dying, that you are important for every day of your life. Because as a Christian, you have unique grounds to say that and mean it. They're made in the image of God, even if they've lost all their capacities, even if they can't get out of bed.
I don't know why it comes from my mind. A lot of maybe it's because there is some, like,
people who don't believe in the image of God can't say that with any grounds.
Yeah.
It's kind of a sentimental thing to say if you don't believe in the image of God. Yeah. You're so important. What do you mean they're important? They're not doing anything. They can't work. Yeah. No, the only reason you can say that is because of the image of God. And so this is one of the things where, like, yes, the Christian faith is actually gives this amazing place to stand in situations like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking of Jesus saying, whoever you give a cup of water to, whoever you feed, who's hungry, whoever you clothe, maybe, you know, visiting, those who are in prison, like showing up and honoring the humanity of this person is honoring Christ. Like, you did this to me. Mm. You did this to another person. Jesus said it, so right. Whatever you need to know about me.
Yep. Yeah.
I think that really helps me think about, like, sometimes, like we were talking about, like, I feel so, like, almost have that the weight. I mean, there is a balance, like, you know, you have the weight of your neighbor's glory, but at the same time, like, you don't, like, do the work, though. Mm. So I always, like, get up in my head, like, oh, I should be witnessing all these different people, and then it becomes about me. Mm-hmm. It doesn't leave it up to, like, the sovereignty of God and His mercy, and only He knows everything about this person's life. Mm-hmm. So if it's out of, like, a spirit of, like, I'm feeling, like, just to appease my conscience, like, it's probably, like...
Right, to tick boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think... maybe we'll wind up there. But thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.